Standing by. At this time, all participants will be in a listen-only mode until the question-and-answer session. To ask a question at that time, please press star then one. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. With that, it is my pleasure to turn over today's call to Mr. William Saunders. You may begin.
I am not Bill Saunders. I'm Keith Marzullo. I've known Bill for a long time, and it's really a pleasure to have him here as our distinguished lecture speaker for today. Even though I've known him for a long time, I'm going to read his bio because there are many details here that you should know. As we're just talking about, I still think of him as being an Arizona professor, and that was 17 years ago. William Saunders is a Donald Bigger Wiggett Willis, I'm sorry, professor of engineering and the director of the Coordinated Science Laboratory at the at University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. He is a fellow of the IEEE and of the ACM, a past chair of the IEEE Technical Committee on Fault-Tolerant Computing, and past vice chair of the OCTIP Working Group 10.4 on Dependable Computing. His research interests include secure and dependable computing and security, and dependability metrics and evaluation with a focus on critical infrastructure. He is currently the director and PI of the DOE DHS Trustworthy Cyber Infrastructure of the Power Grid, or TCIPG Center, which was initially funded by NSF, I might point out. He's also a member of the NIST Smart Grid Advisory Committee, and this is just a drop of the things that Bill's involved in. So let me bring Bill.
Thank you, Keith. That's really nice. You didn't tell any of the terrible stories I thought you might be able to tell, but so I won't tell any of them either. Well, thank you. It's a real honor. Thanks for inviting me here. It's a real honor to be here today. And I really relish the opportunity to be able to talk about these topics. It's something that I believe passionately in. It's something that whether we've been working on power grids or whether we've been working on communication systems or defense systems, I've been thinking about for a long time. And it's something that's controversial. The idea of security metrics in Washington, from everything I hear, even from a distance, is everybody's talking about it, right? And everybody has an opinion. This is a talk that's really about the beginning, I think, of a path towards quantifiable security metrics, not the end. But it's a path that I think is really important. It's a path that I think the time is right to go down. 10 years ago, 15 years ago, people were saying, well, yeah, that's a great problem, but it's been a great problem for 40 years, and it's just too hard. And I believe it's the right time to be going down it today. And so what I'm going to try to do is give a mix. Part talk that's an advocate for that position, and part talk that's technical and tells you what we've been doing in that regard for the last few years. So that's the sort of intro to the presentation. I'll have some more acknowledgments at the end, but I should say some acknowledgments. This work has been funded by the Department of Homeland Security in Doug Maughan's program for the last 3 years, so we're very thankful for that. It's also had funding from Hewlett-Packard, General Electric, and IBM. And so one of the things you're going to see as we go forward, whereas academics are arguing about whether it's possible to do quantitative security metrics, industry needs them, and industry's doing it, whether they're doing it rightly or wrongly. And so I think this combination of working together with academics and industry to find a path forward is really important. Okay, so what's the argument? Whether we like it or not, we're spending a lot of money on security, resilience, and trust. It's a big problem. I don't need to argue that here at NSF. NSF has a leadership program in that area for a decade or more, there's much good research going on arguing about how can we build secure and resilient systems. I think the other thing we've learned in the last decade is that we can't build systems that are perfectly secure. Yes, we can build systems that have high assurance. There's many things that we should do to try to achieve that, depending on what our budget, and what our aims, and what our goals are. But there are limitations, and system security won't be perfect or absolute. Now, if it's not perfect or absolute, then the question naturally arises is, how good is it? And what I'd like to argue today, really, is that there are there are at least a couple of questions we want to try to answer, and they have differing difficulties. One might be, which systems are more secure? And I think this is a very important question. Note that it does not have to have an answer that gives an absolute quantitative value for security to be able to answer. This is just a question, is A better than B? And I think that's very important, particularly at the design stage, particularly at the architecting stage of the system for security. And then the second question might be, and how much more secure are they? And so one of the basic tenets I want to start with, and it sounds like a philosophical point of view I came to after thinking about this problem for a long time, is that if we say the Holy Grail is an absolute number, a number that's known to 5-9 decimal points, right, like the goal for high availability systems or the goal for aircraft of 9-9, then we're going to fail. Problem's too hard, we're not going to be able to make a passport. But if we say that we need an engineering basis for security and trust in which we can make informed decisions about paths to take when architecting systems, then I think we can make progress. And we are making progress in many domains, from the government and national security agencies to the DOD to NSF, that there are real strides we can make forward in that way. And it's useful even if it isn't perfect. Now, the other point I want to make before I get on to a bit more technical presentation is that when one talks about security metrics, you can mean many things. You can mean process-oriented metrics, right? Checklists that say these are good security practices you can take. You can mean kinds of metrics that are used in the design and architecting phase. That's what I'm going to primarily talk about today. You can mean metrics that are used experimentally in the field, things related to penetration testing, things related to other kinds of automated testing of implementation. All of those are important. All of those are useful. We need to make progress in all of them. And it's not one or the other. If a system has architecture flaws, no matter how well you implement it, it's still going to have architecture flaws and not be secure. It doesn't have architecture flaws, but when you implement it incorrectly, then we'll have implementation flaws, and those also can be security vulnerabilities. So you need all of these things. But today I'm really going to focus on the architecture point of view. Am I doing okay?
I can stand over here. It's a little constraining, but I'm not moving too much anyway. Okay, so that's what we're going to talk about today. Okay, so why do we want to use this kind of evaluation? And I think I've talked about this informally already, to get a big picture view of a security perspective, right? How there's a relationship between component level insecurities and overall system security. That mapping or that understanding is complex. We need to look at it. And really, if you have a fixed budget and you have choices about what to do, how should you make those security investments? In many cases, when we work with industry, there's a question. Should we invest more in security education? Should we invest more in security policies? Or should we invest more in security technology? And the only way to answer that rationally is through these kinds of assessments. And so that's the kind of thing. So I'm focusing on the early stage. I'm focusing on architectural design, system design. Can be fairly technical. Maybe this can be used in configuration design, but we still need those other kinds of metrics or assessment. I don't know what the culture is here, but whether questions need to be at the end or whether they can be at the end. Okay, then I guess I need to go forward and keep going. Make sure we get to the questions in time. Okay, so what's the situation today? And again, I'm being a little bit facetious, but this is what we've really observed. We went out and spent a lot of time talking to people in industry and government. It's really sort of two fundamental ways in which people are making security decisions. One is to rely on a wise individual, right, a gray beard or a wizard that analyzes a design, looks at it, and says, I think it's this secure, or I think these changes need to be made to make it secure. Now, that's perhaps a very good way to make decisions, but it relies on that one individual. It's hard to make it scalable. It's hard to audit it later to know why you made the decision, and it's hard to create more of these wizards that we can use. Another way we see, and I see this in the corporate environment when we've worked with them, is more a roundtable type discussion, where you get people together with different expertise. You get the people who are system administrators and understand about hardware configuration and software configuration. You get the people that understand about training together. You get the people that understand about corporate policy together. Trouble is, they talk different languages, and again, they have different currencies by which they're measuring security. And so it's difficult to compare alternatives across the board with regard to these things. So these are the challenges. These are the way it's done today. In fact, I even heard in a corporate setting, we get together in a round table around a glass of a good bottle of red wine. We talk, we make some decisions, and we move forward. And so what we really need, if we're going to have, let alone a science of security, but an engineering of security, is we need ways in which, even if they're not perfect, to enable those engineers, to enable those decision makers to make decisions, even if they're not perfect, and then later know why they made those decisions and go back and make changes to those decisions if they need to. And so that's what we're really looking for. So you see things there. Creating tools to allow these diverse stakeholders to express these different aspects of security. Let them express their concerns and do it in a way that they can work towards a decision about architecture or about design. And do it in a way that's auditable, so 6 months from now they can decide whether it's still the right decision at that date in future or whether there's a different decision they should come to about the architecture. Just to give you a feeling of where we're going, and this is a slide you'll see again at the end of the talk, but I want to show you the kinds of tools I think we can create. Without going into the details, and I'll go into the technical details in a minute, this is something called an attack execution graph. Looks sort of like an attack tree or an attack graph. The boxes are attack steps. The circles are goals that attackers might be trying to achieve. And the boxes and the triangles are some representation of state of the system. The lines drawn on there show the output of the quantitative analysis from the approach we've taken and show how different attackers with different aims and with different preferences with regard to how they might attack are most likely to attack the system. And there are numbers behind these arrows. We can say how likely it is these different kinds of things happen. But I think the numbers in the absolute are suspect, but the numbers I think I can argue for you in a relative way and in a comparative way are giving us a lot of information about how we need to secure the system. We understand, for example, in this particular case, that the arrow that a lot of arrows are going through this, I think it says alter protection settings box, and that says that's a place where we need to place our efforts as we try to make a system more secure. We also can understand that different kinds of potential attackers will attack the system in different ways. So there are numbers behind this. It's interesting to look at the numbers and their relative values, but we also get a lot of insight from being able to quantitatively build. The blue is the output of the analysis that's done based on an attack execution graph that a architect or a designer builds. Okay? So there's a little bit of related work, and I don't have a lot of time. The thing about security metrics is that there are many methodologies, some grounded in sort of, if you will, good evidence, some not. And I wanted to tell you about two general classes of methodology that motivated our work. The first is the long-time tradition, starting with in the fault tolerant computing community of fault trees and then now attack trees and attack graphs and privilege graphs that try to map out, either in a combinatorial way with attack graphs and attack trees or in a state-based way with privilege graphs, ways in which the system, from the point of view of the attacker, is organized with respect to making it secure. And this is interesting and good work, and I'd have to say particularly attack trees and attack graphs are the dominant way this is done now in practice when you try to do a security evaluation. But they have limitations because they don't explicitly look at how an attacker behaves and what the attack, they don't model the attacker. And in doing so, they don't take into account differences that the different attackers might have with regard to the ways in which they attack. The second thing that they don't do generally, and in privilege graphs do this, but they largely don't have a rich notion of state and the interrelationship of how the state of the system evolves over time while it's being used and how that state can affect whether a vulnerability is present or not, right? So you think of a system in its execution, and as it's executing, or as a mission is being carried out, if this is a mission-oriented system, then there may be different, timing may be important, so we need to represent timing somehow. The second large class of related work is in adversary modeling itself. And again, there's a long and rich history of this. It tends to ignore the system aspects. In fact, in a sense, it's based more on classical security. When you have the first breach, the game is over. And so they model attackers in a fairly nice way, but they just ignore the details of how the system is organized, making it hard to look at how you architect the system. And the two that most closely motivated our work is something called MORTA. MORTA was developed at the National Security Agency 10 to 20 years ago. There's publicly available papers you can find on that topic. It's pretty interesting work. And the second is called NRAT, and NRAT is another tool like that that focus more on the network aspects. And these realize that different attackers will behave in different ways. They try to motivate that representation of attacker behavior at a medium level, something more detailed than the sort of Kitty Scripters to nation state model that we see talked about so much, and something higher level than a vulnerability database, which is so fine-grained that you should say, well, if it's in a vulnerability database, you should fix it. And if you fix it, then you perhaps don't need to worry about it anymore. And so that's not very helpful either. And so our work really combines, as you see, both the state-based model analysis that comes both from these sort of privilege graphs and attack graphs, and the attacker modeling that's been used on the other side of this fence, if you will, for quite a while. So what does ADVISE do? And it stands for Adversary View Security Evaluation. It's driven by adversary analysis. So there's explicit representation of adversaries, and not exactly what adversaries will do, but what their preferences are. Are they noisy or are they quiet? Are they worried about how costly attacks are or not, and so forth? And different adversaries will have different propensities when you go towards that. It's a state-based analysis. And so, in a sense, what we try to do is combine the ease, the acceptance in industry and in the practitioner's field of attack graphs and attack trees, with a more realistic state-based analysis of privilege graphs, but in a way that security practitioners can believe in. They're quantitative. And again, I hope I've explained myself. I don't naively think these are absolute numbers that come out, but these are numbers that guide design and configuration decisions. And they have metrics that are fairly high level and relevant to the mission or relevant to the application. And there's a lot of people that talk about, well, what's the right security metric? And I would argue that there's no single right security metric, that there's many different metrics you're going to need for many different purposes. But for the purposes of these high-level architecture studies, you want metrics that relate to, can the system fulfill the mission, or is the system operation proper with respect to what it was designed to do, right? Or as we saw in the Trust in Cyberspace report that Fred Schneider led many years ago now, you know, does the system do what it's expected to do and nothing else? And so we have a way of quantifying that at a high level. Okay? So just to give an example, and I'm not going to belabor it, this is a simple, maybe small, SCADA network. Typically in the power grid, there are these things called SCADA. SCADA is, well, I can't tell you what exactly every letter means, but it's the process control network that just has the sensors and the actuators with regard to the grid. The control network here is hoped is very secure. It's typically behind two firewalls. The firewall, it will have a connection to the corporate network. There are rules about what can flow back and forth there, and then ultimately the corporate network will have a connection to the Internet. If I wanted to attack this, how might I attack it? Well, I might work my way into the corporation, and then I might do a physical attack on the corporate network, right? Find a way to plug into a jack in the corporate network and then work my way from the corporate network to the SCADA network. Or I might sit far away and I might try to go through the corporate VPN. So these are two possibilities an attacker, if you're going to think like an attacker, you might think about doing. And we need to represent these kinds of possibilities and the overall steps that an attack might take in a logical way in order to do the analysis. Okay, this is a highlight of the overview of the approach, and I'll walk you through it, showing what we've done in each of these areas. And the end part of the story is we'll show you a prototype tool that is now used in, or has been tested in, about 10 different corporate and government locations. And we're still taking a lot of feedback, and we're making a lot of improvements, but we think we're on the right path going forward. So the first step in all of this is, how do we represent the system? How do we represent the system? And that's done through something called an attack execution graph. We added the word execution to attack graph to make very explicit that this is a richer notation than the combinatorial notation that one might that one typically has, in that it takes into account the state of the system. And it's a dynamic evolution over time. So there's an execution in which the attacker works his or her way through the system. So an attack execution graph, what is it? It's a set of attack steps. Relative to our little example, here's the attack step that says gain corporate network access through local physical access. I get through the door. I somehow get on the corporate network. I might come in a cyber way through the VPN. And it takes into account here access, skill, and knowledge of the attacker in order to enable or disenable certain steps attackers might take at any point in time. So these three constructs, access, skill, and knowledge, can be dynamic. Well, skill, we believe, is at least on the time scale of the analysis, is something an attacker has or doesn't have, and it can be black and white, it can be binary, or it can be a more continuous value. And then knowledge and access are things that evolve over time. The attacker may learn something through a step that helps him or her in the next step, and the attacker access really represents the place in the system, or the degree to which the attacker has currently infiltrated the system. Okay, so the idea, what's new relative to attack graphs, is this new idea of having a notion of state that's access, skill, and knowledge. There are steps, as are traditional. They're also richer. We'll show you how those do. And the steps can then lead to changes in state variable, for example, access to the corporate network in this case. And then we'll look at this as an evolution in time. And I need to go jump in and tell you a little more about the details now. So here's an attack execution graph, and the formal notation really isn't important here, except that it is formal and precise, in which we can prove things about the optimality of the analysis. We can sometimes compute analytical or numerical solutions as well as simulation solutions. But for now, I just want to show you the basics. So what's an attack execution graph? It's a set of attack steps. For example, access the network using the VPN. It's a set of access domains, and that represents things like the privilege, as I talked about. It's a set of knowledge items. And again, you can define these how you want for a particular system. It's a set of adversary attack skills. Again, different adversaries will have different levels of skill in different categories. And it's a set of attack goals. And different adversaries will have desires in different proportion to achieve different attack goals. So this is what it is, and of course there's a more formal and more precise definition that we need to use when we write the algorithms about how these things execute. But today I'm just going to present this to you at a high level. An attack step is, in a sense, the most rich of these constructs, and an attack step is really the event, if you will, in the system that can change knowledge and access. And so we need to talk about how that might occur. So what's an attack step? There's some precondition that says in this access skill and knowledge, in this current state of the system, can the attack begin? Okay. There's a time it takes to complete the attack step. And again, one will argue, well, I don't know what the time is. It may be variable. Well, we can make it variable. It can be a random variable. But the key here is that we are making our best guess for what these things are. We're doing sensitivity analysis because we can solve thousands of these models, if you will, at once in parallel with the system we built to look at sensitivity analysis. And then we're documenting what our decisions are so later we can say, well, we think that was wrong. Let's go back and change it. So we have a disciplined, auditable procedure for learning how we made these kind of decisions. Anyway, so this is the time to attempt, the time it takes to attempt the step, the cost of attempting the step, the set of outcomes that might come when the step is taken. Simply, it might just be success and failure, but there could be gray areas of the outcomes, probabilities of those various outcomes, the probability of an attack being detected when a certain outcome occurs, and the next state that represents the, how the access skill and knowledge changes as the outcome occurs. So again, these kinds of things, and you'll see there's a graphical and GUI-based approach in which you document these kind of decisions. They can be done in a collaborative way. And then we know the decisions we've made, and we can analyze the sensitivity of those decisions to our decisions we make about security design, and we can go back and question them later if we want to. Okay. This is kind of a technicality, but every attack execution graph has something called a do-nothing step, and this represents the fact that at a particular point in time, a particular access skill and knowledge, a particular state, that the adversary may choose it's not the right time to attempt an attack step and then do nothing. And in fact, maybe a good design would force the attacker into this step quite often. And so the details are here, but basically, and you can set it however you want for the situation, but basically a do-nothing attack step doesn't gain you much. As you see there, you won't get detected, but you won't make progress either. Okay, next thing I want to talk about is adversaries. And this work is motivated closely by the work that I told you about done at NSA. On MORTA, and we like philosophically how MORTA represented adversaries. Again, it did so in a way that didn't represent the system in the rich way that I've told you today. But let me dive right in. So what's an adversary look like? An adversary starts somewhere, just like when you do a red team game, or just like when you do a pen test, you may start the game from different points and put the adversary in different places to look at how they can progress, right? And this is akin to that. So we have a starting position, a starting access skill and knowledge for that adversary. We have for each attack skill a level for the adversary. How good are they at these things? You might say, well, what are the units? Well, again, the units are relative, and they're relative to, as you'll see, the precondition, the Boolean precondition about when an attack can be attempted can depend on all these parameters, and also things such as the time and the probability of outcome. Everything that I told you about on the last slide can be state-dependent and dependent on the characteristics of the adversary. An attack goal value function, so to what level do they value each of the goals they might be going after. Different adversaries will value different kinds of goals. Attack preference rates, and this is weights, and this is very important. This gives the relative importance that this kind of adversary places on cost, payoff, and detection probability. So these aren't values for these things. These are how important is it to this adversary that when it attempts something, it gets a payoff? How important is it to the adversary that he's not detected when he attempts something? And you can imagine different kinds of adversaries will have different propensities to these kinds of things. And since these are relative weights, and you'll see how they come up in the optimization analysis, they can help us understand the different ways different adversaries might behave. I think it's allowed. I'll repeat the question. Please go ahead.
So are you assuming that the system itself is static because if it is using some moving target dependence technique?
Great question.
Then
yeah. So the system does have state in what I'm telling you today. The question was, are you considering that the system is static or is the system dynamic, for example, using a moving target defense? In what I'm telling you today, there's three aspects of system state. As I said, there's skill, access, and knowledge. And it's fairly adversary related. The access is the, if you will, part of the system state that the system may be dynamically fighting back, right, pushing access in the other direction. I'm not going to talk about that explicitly in this talk, but these models, the attack execution graphs and the adversary models, can be composed together. And in practice, when we use this, they're composed together with another system model that has its own transitions where the system observes the axis of the adversary and may take action. And I'm getting into more technical details than I can in the amount of time we have, but the Mobius modeling tool in which this is implemented has a rich structure for model composition. And so there's a third model, a system model, that talks about events that the system may take. And the way in which these models interact is through sharing the view of these state variables. Did that help? So we look at proactive and reactive defenses in systems in that way, and moving target would be a perfect thing you could look at. Okay, great question. And then there's a planning horizon. And the planning horizon says, how far ahead does this adversary look? Now, if you knew where I was going, you're going to see that we're going to be doing a combined game theoretic simulation solution approach to solve this. And one of the things we need to do is have a finite planning horizon in the game. So you might say, oh, Sanders put this in to get himself out of a mathematical problem about this infinite horizon. But and yeah, maybe that's why we thought of that in the first place. But as we thought about it more and as we talked particularly with some of our government contacts, the idea of adversaries that have limited planning horizons and the practical observation of adversaries that seem to sort of be bouncing around without too many aims, and then they get to a certain state, and then suddenly they home in on going towards certain goals, suggests a behavior that could be indicative that, well, they can only plan so far ahead, and only after they gain some more access, skill, and knowledge can they start homing in on what their goals are. And so this has turned out not just to be a mathematical construct, but a very useful construct in saying, well, depending how far an adversary can look ahead, how effective will they be? And so we've studied that extensively in some of the case studies. I'm not really talking too much about the case studies here, but that's I think, an important construct. Okay, so that's the adversary representation. The third thing we need to represent is what's the security question or what's the metric we're asking. And I won't say much about this, except that it's very general. There's a language for describing these mission-oriented goals. They can represent anything you want, any function of model state. They can represent things about timing of events, how often are certain attack steps attempted, how likely is a goal to be reached, what's the relative rate at which different goals will be reached, will a goal be reached before another goal, and so forth. So there's a rich, what we call a reward model-based language for describing these kind of mission-oriented metrics. And I'll show you an example soon, which will show some of that. Okay. The last part I want to show you before I move on to a quick example is, in some sense, the core of how this works. And something we spent a lot of time thinking about, and we've been sort of evolving this over the last few years. And in a sense, what we want to do is build a way in which we can compose together attack execution graphs and adversary models, and if we want, also compose together a system model that looks at how the system reacts as this is going on. By the way, we're also studying with NSA support how to put a fourth model in that looks at the good human users of the system and how they impact security, right? Because a human user can create or not create vulnerabilities as they use it. So there's really four aspects, although I'm concentrating on two of them today. And so how do we actually execute this in a way that we can get credible results of that? And something that someone told me early on when I gave a presentation was, I want to be surprised by the model results. One of the criticisms of the early survivability simulation work that was done was that you had to specify an attacker at a level of detail that pretty much you knew what the attacker was going to do. And if you're not surprised, then you really aren't learning anything. So what we had to find is a level of representation that people were comfortable with populating these values I just talked about, that they didn't know exactly what the outcome was going to be before they did the analysis, that perhaps they were surprised by the outcome. But then once they saw the outcome, they thought about it more carefully, and they said, yeah, that's really credible, right? We don't have any proof or validation that these models really represent reality yet. That's only going to come over time. But we need models, and I've done this in other domains, in the fault-tolerant computing domain in industry. You need models in which they actually give people advice that they didn't know before they started, and yet when they think about that advice, it's credible. They can understand why that makes sense. And so that's sort of, we were thinking about that both as we defined the level of detail of this modeling and as we came up with the analysis approach. And here's basically how we did it. At the highest level, there's a fairly standard, and I should say there are analytic solutions to these models. We're just finalizing a paper now in which you can do some mathematical solutions. There's some pretty interesting properties because of the way they're formally defined. But at the level I'm going to talk about today, it looks like a fairly traditional simulation loop at the high level where you're in some state, you determine all the available attack steps in that state, you choose the most attractive of those attack steps using, I have to define what I mean by attractive, you stochastically select the outcome among the ones that are equally most attractive, update the state and loop. So the interesting part of this whole loop is how do you choose the most attractive attack steps, really? How, out of the many things that the attacker could do, that the precondition is true, to be more technical about this, how do you choose which one the attacker will do next? And that has to be done in a way that takes into account the preferences of the adversary and the state and so forth. So here's the little simulation loop written out a little more technically, and the really interesting thing is this adversary attack decision, okay? And to just talk about this at a high level, and I could have spent the whole hour talking about sort of, if you will, the mathematics about how this is done, but what we're doing is at each step, when this choice is made, each step in that loop, we're solving a Markov decision process-like solution. We're doing an optimization solution that says, what's the optimal thing for the attacker to do next, given the characteristics of the attacker? So, as it says there, it says the attractiveness of a next available attack step is a function of the payoff of the expected states n steps ahead, if I'm looking n steps forward, and the expected cost and detection of those n steps. Okay, so I'm looking forward, much like I would in a game theoretic solution, and I'm I'm ranking all the next steps in terms of their attractiveness. So here's the function. You know, the attractiveness is a weighted combination, again, without spending time on details because I want to show the example, but a weighted combination of cost, payoff, and detection. And we create, if you will, and there's a lot of ways in which you make this very efficient, but we in some sense solve a markup decision process optimization problem at each step in the loop of the simulation. You might say, oh, that's very expensive, and I was worried about that being very expensive, but the simulation does, in a practical way, execute very fast. And there's a lot of knowledge that we can use about the solution at one step that makes it efficient to solve it again in the next step through. Okay? So this is a little animation that shows you how this is computed, but basically we have to choose, at this case, we have to choose among a set of available next attack steps that we can take. And we do that by, if n equals 1, it's simple. We do that by just computing the values of the various choices, and we pick the most attractive one. So in this case, it's the do-nothing attack step. It's more interesting when you have a multi-level attack tree. You have to sort of recurse down and recurse up, and you make these computations. And as you're recursing up, in a sense where there's choices, you have to make a choice at a certain level and then propagate that choice up, working my way all the way up to find out what the next step choice is. Now, if you've been paying attention and if you know this kind of mathematics, there are only certain times in which you can make these intermediate choices. And, in fact, it's a Markov decision process solution if you can make the choice at each step. And to be technical about this, the solution that we have with this attractiveness function will be optimal with respect to the point of view of the attacker in certain situations, not in all situations. And basically, it will be optimal if this attractiveness function is either wholly linear or wholly multiplicative, and it will be wholly linear if I just have cost and payoff, and it will be wholly multiplicative if I only have weights on detection. So what that's saying, if I use this attractiveness function, then I can study cases in which I have cost and payoffs that the adversary cares about but not detection, or cares about detection but not cost and payoff. Now, there's fix, and the fix basically is to represent the detection probability, or what turns out to be the non-detection probability, in a log way. And then we look at a geometric sum, and we get around this problem. But again, I think I better show you the example in which. So what's the practical implication of all this? Practical implication is we're doing a simulation, we're in a sense, but in each step in the simulation, unlike earlier kinds of survivability analysis, we're making optimal decisions or worst-case decisions with respect to the preferences of adversaries. So there's a case study I want to show you. It's a case study of the distribution side of a power grid. It's a technology called a pull-top recloser that may be put in. And without going into the technical detail of pull-top, and I have people who know more about this than me in the audience, I know, but a pull-top recloser can be a way to have a second circuit, if you will, that can be closed. And if there's a fault in the line that causes an outage on a certain feeder circuit, that a second feeder circuit can feed that first one and help keep the power on to those houses or those businesses, whoever was on that feeder. Now, the question from a security point of view is it a good idea? Do we increase the availability of power on the grid if we put radio reclosers, if we put this cyber feature on these pull-top reclosers and manipulate them, you know, from the control station? And the positive benefits are we can avoid outages because we can fix problems that occur. The potential problem is that we can provide an attack vector for an adversary who might try to control these pull-top reclosers. We've learned interesting things about how the passwords work on them and how they're coordinated. That's not the subject of this talk, but there are a lot of risks with doing these kind of things as well. So here's the attack execution graph. for this system. This is the one without the pole top radio reclosers. You can see a mapping between the physical relationship and the attack execution graph. This is a realistic model for a typical industrial setting that's been sanitized in a way that we can present it. You can see architectures of this type, for example, in the book by Schweitzer on power grid system architectures. This is how the attackers that we studied. We studied attackers that had various cost detection and payoff preferences. So we studied six different attackers here. Everything from an attacker, they're always foreign governments, right, not domestic governments, but attackers that don't really have much preference for cost and maybe equal preference for detection and payoff. Attackers that might have more preference for cost and other things, for example, an insider engineer would need to have a pretty big payoff. So we looked at how different attackers would behave that have different preferences with this kind of attack execution graph. What are the metrics? The average number of attempts that different kinds of adversaries will make at each kind of attack step. The probability that certain goals will be achieved within a certain period of time and the average time to achieve those goals. So you can see how these can be very mission-oriented metrics. There's a tool. As I said, this is built on top of an extensive modeling tool for system availability and reliability and performance, in fact, funded by the Next Generation Software Program at NSF over many years back in the mid-90s, a tool called Mobius. We built these security formalisms on top of Mobius, so we inherit all the, if you will, execution power of the Mobius tool, and that's widely distributed. 500 or 700 site licenses have been given out, and it's used widely now. So this has been built on top of Mobius. This is how we represent adversaries. Pretty easy to represent them. So you see this is an adversary that has some initial knowledge, some initial access, some goals, and some relative payoffs that it gives to those goals. And then we get results. And as I said, there are numbers behind these results, but the interesting thing is we find is that as we study this more and more with more and more systems, that different adversaries tend to act in quite different ways. And it's not like a single adversary will have many different paths, all of equal probability. That would be sort of a bad result. And obviously, you can construct a system where that would be the case. But for the practical systems we've been constructing, we tend to see that different adversaries tend to behave in different ways that have a lot of cluster in how they behave. So we see this result without the recloser radios. And then you see, here's the interesting thing, if I go back and forth, when you add these recloser radios, you can see how the attackers really focus on them. And they really, it's an argument for how secure and how you have to focus your attention on implementation validation of security on different things depending on the system. And this really helps you focus that next stage of security testing once you've done the architectural analysis. There are other kinds of metrics that are interesting. Here's the time to achieve attack goals. And I want to say right off, don't really worry much about this, the units on this axis. But it's interesting that different kinds of attackers will have different major goals, and they will take different times to do that in a relative sense. And again, this is all about gaining insight into the system that help you from an architecture and design point of view, and so you can see these kind of things. And then this graph I'll just put on very quickly, and you need another piece of it that I didn't put on the slide in order to interpret it, but these are different attack steps. You got to know which attack steps they are for this to be interesting, so I apologize. I just realized that it wasn't color-coded in the right way. But these are different attack steps, and you can see that different kinds of adversaries will try different kinds of attack steps, and they'll try them with different frequencies. And that also, I think, is very interesting information as you try to architect secure systems. What's the future? And the question was a perfect setup question, is how does this all to fit together? Well, I told you how to model adversaries and how to model the system from an adversary viewpoint. We also need to model both the system itself and how the system responds, and we need to model humans and how the good humans, just like the adversaries, interact with the system. So we have a new project starting that's looking at modeling cyberhuman systems from a security point of view, and we are looking at the concepts of opportunity, willingness, and capability as a organizing construct, just like access, skill, and knowledge is from the human side. And we're building formalisms that look somewhat like process-oriented models in which show how humans use these systems and how humans can affect their security. So here's an acknowledgement slide. Of course, this is the work of many people who have done more of the detailed work than me. Mike Ford and Elizabeth LeMay were PhD students. Elizabeth just finished her PhD and has got a lecturer position at the university now, but is exploring a lot of options. Ken Keith is a full-time senior programmer who builds our software tools and is the lead developer of the Mobius tool. We found in order to have impact in these kind of tools, you can't just prove theorems and do the math. You have to build real tools people can use. And as we said, we've got thousands of users of Mobius, many fewer users of the security extensions so far. But Ken is the full-time keeper of that code and leads other developers. Carol Murky from the Cyber Defense Agency was a collaborator with us on this project. We work closely with people at the NSA, particularly on the adversary side of the modeling equation, and we work closely with GE Research in the energy division, and this is being used to model some of their architectures. And as I said, this research was funded by Science and Technology at DHS, by GE Research, by the NSA Science of Security Center. As we talked over the last few years. So what's the punchline? I believe very strongly the quantitative security evaluation of this type or of others, there's a whole groundswell of these kind of things starting to come up now, is useful even if it isn't perfect. We have to move away from the holy grail of saying if it's not absolute and it's not completely accurate, it's not useful, right? We heard famous statisticians say all models are wrong, some models are useful, right? And this is in that category, that we can use these things to make useful design and configuration decisions that at least, I hope, and we can talk about this more offline, are better than the kind of decisions that are being made today, driving us towards an engineering of security. That this is just the beginning of the story, not the end, but in the way to move it forward is to get practical tools in the hands of people that they can try and they can find out what's wrong with it. And we're gathering a lot of data, and we're going to be changing quite a bit of this in the future to move it towards a practical tool that people can actually use to architect these systems. But you need to put those things out in the field so you can get feedback on how to change it. In addition to that kind of thing, there's a lot more work to be done on very quick analytic solutions of these models, just like we have analytic solutions of fault trees, right? There's things that can be done there, just like we have analytic solutions of Markov models of tens or hundreds of millions of states. We know how to do that. And then a very important thing is modeling the human behavior side and the system reaction side. I didn't talk about the system reaction side, but that we pretty much know how to do. But modeling the human behavior side is a much bigger challenge. And this is the good humans now, the human users. And so that's what I have today. I don't know how much time I have, but I'd be happy to answer questions. I hope you found that interesting and useful. I'll turn it back over to Keith, who can be the...
We do have time for questions. Do you have any questions?
Krishna, please.
Yeah, so going back to your remarkable decision process, that involves a number of parameters like cost and rate and probability. So, and in many instances, you may not have those probabilities of the cost figured out correctly.
Right.
So I'm wondering if there is a notion of robustness here that you have looked at.
So the question was that you may not know many of the parameter values exactly. And when you put those in, you may come up to different, if the parameter values change, you may come up to different solutions when we're doing this markup decision process solution, and then ultimately the overall simulation solution. And the question is there a notion of robustness? There's no formal notion of robustness that I can make proofs of now. You know, I can't say things in an analytic sense about insensitivity to parameters. And I'd love to be able to do that. Maybe I can do that. Maybe I can't. I don't know. Probably I can do it in some limited cases, but I definitely can't do it in general. But from a practical point of view, how people who are using this now, our first alpha users, if you will, are using it, they're doing very wide-scale sensitivity analysis. And because of the way all this is automated, there's the notion of things called experiments and studies, and you can do a study in which you explore a parameter input space with many different experiments in a fairly automatic way, and you can get graphs, topology graphs, that look... So for any particular system, I can tell you those sensitivities, but it's in that brute force way, not in a beautiful mathematical way. But that's where we've got to go, and we need to understand that, right? Because even if we don't know them, it's going to be really interesting to know how sensitive are those parameters to your decisions. Because if you don't know the value, if it's really sensitive, then you better figure out what the value is, right? So you can use this in reverse, too, which is what people have been doing in practice. But that's a great question. Sam? All right. I'm going to let Keith control it, but I asked for Sam, so we'll start there.
So I'll apologize if that's a difficult question.
No, no problem. Yeah. That's why I'm here.
So there's been lots of discussion lately about the science of security.
Yep.
And one of the big gaps is that, like in our field, like software engineering, there's been decades of methodologies and analysis techniques. It's been suggested that very few work in this.
Mm-hmm.
And just evaluating per hour of user time, what benefit does this have? And so, for instance, in your tool, what benefit, how can you measure the effectiveness of your work as opposed to, say, Microsoft, your development lifecycle, and what are the best, most effective
right. Steps
in your process? Do you have any thoughts about how you would actually go about trying to measure that?
Yeah, no, I have lots of thoughts about this, and I mean, I have to tell you that question, when we started this work, I mean, was paramount on my mind. And in fact, you know, if I couldn't get comfortable with it in my own mind, we weren't even going to go forward. So let me tell you what we did, just very briefly, because I know there's other people who want to ask questions. And it's a really tough question. I don't really have an answer to your question yet. But what we did is we went around and we asked a lot of people. People in government, people who do this for their daily business in government, people in industry. And we asked them the question, you know, how do we validate these models? How do we be sure we're doing something useful that doesn't misguide people? And the answer I came to isn't really that labeled me to go forward with the research, which isn't really completely satisfying, is people are making these decisions today, and they're doing it using a whole variety of methods. And so, in a sense, I lowered the bar of my expectation of a full validation by saying, I believe that I can do better than we're doing today, rather than just, I'm going to do it perfectly. You know, and the saying we came to with my team was, we're becoming more comfortable with the fact we're very uncomfortable with the approach. Okay, So I just want to admit that first. So I honest answer is I don't know any way in which to validate, if you will, the correctness or the approach of this rather than through careful use over time and studying it. I know that's expensive, and I know that's hard to do. But remember, we're making these decisions every day. We're deciding whether to make my firewall more secure, spend more money on education, or do this and that. And so what we have to do is we have to try to use these kind of approaches. We have to document. I've worked as consultants in the industry, more on the fault-tolerance side than the security side, because that was back in the 90s. But you document everything you do, and you go back and you look at the decisions. And really, the best I can say is only over time will we know. Now, in comparison, I'm not sure if you asked this, but in comparison with other approaches like Microsoft's secure code design process, these aren't either or, right? We need to be doing all these things. And even in validation, I mean, I could have come up today and talked to you about some operational firewall testing things that we're developing that are used in the field based on formal method approaches. So, you know, we need all those tools. This tool isn't the holy grail, but it's the tool. It's the beginnings of a tool that I think the directions we should take towards a system design architecture process. But no, I'm not going to be able to go off and you give me $100,000 and I write a proof and then we know that it works, right? It's more complicated than that. And so that's why we involve industry so closely in this, and we get them to try it and we get a lot of feedback, and then feedback on all sorts of levels. But, yeah, hard question, and I think we just have to – what I came to was that it was still useful to go forward even though it was a hard question. And that's really – it took a lot of time to come to that. You know, there were many questions.
We do have time left, so I'll ask you more. But
okay.
One question I had primarily is, so this tool is very nice in finding out the weakest link in the chain,
yep,
given a certain set of conditions. But however, once you fix the weakest link, there's going to be other links that are going to pop up, into the next weaker link.
Yeah, well, obviously you can study that, right?
And the thing is, right, it's easy if the tool points out one weak link, which is okay, like I can fix this, and maybe, okay, my cost benefit analysis works.
Yep. Yep.
If it points out, like, for example, without the reclosed radius in that example, you had like 7 different attack paths, and you are thinking, the organization is thinking, which one should I fix first? It's a cost, ultimately, it's a cost thing, right? Because if I have infinite money, I'll fix everything.
Yep.
Right? So, what is the policy? I mean, I'm just making a more rhetorical question. So, what
no.
Do we,
no, it's a.
If you think it's viable.
Okay. So, it's a great question. And, you know, the question, this is a general system analysis question. I've worked in the performance field, I've worked in the reliability field, I've worked in the security field, and always in these kind of system analysis environments. And the answer is, the tool doesn't just give a magic answer and then you go do it. It's humans and the insights that you gain out of the tool, together with humans that think about it, that make those decisions. Now, take the first example where different kinds of attackers took different paths, but there were lots of different paths, right? Well, then what does that tell you? You need to think about which kinds of attackers are most important to you, right? That suggests you should think about that. And so, you know, I had a mentor, Bill Carter, one of the pioneers and founders of the field of fault-tolerant computing back in the late 70s and early 80s when I was a grad student. And Bill Carter said to me once when we first met, he said, it's not about numbers, it's about insights. And, you know, actually he said, damn it, it's not about numbers, it's about insights. And I think that's so important that we're not going to take the human out of the equation, but we're going to, you asked a really good question. I haven't gotten deeply into big security projects where I've helped a team work through that process in security yet. I have, as a consultant for several companies over a decade in the availability and reliability space, and the way you answer those questions is you use these kind of tools as guides and as ways in which to get data that you then have discussions about, and then you make decisions. And that's, you know, that's the way it's going to be here too. And, you know, that's the way it is in the locked rooms around this place and in the corporate offices too, right, where those decisions are being made today. It's just that they, at least to my knowledge, don't have these kinds of tools to help them with the decision. So that's I think, the best we can do today. But great question. Who else?
I have time for one more question.
I'm sorry. I went on too long, and I was trying to be short.
There have been studies that have looked at using the number of attackers who are participating in a conspiracy.
Right.
To look at, for example, voting. I'm curious, are there other fields where people use, where the number of attackers is the most important metric versus the skill they have or the tools or things like that? And does that affect use the tool in the same way?
No, great question again. So I would guess it was very system dependent if the number of attackers, you know, was important or the skill of an attacker was more important. So I can say you should use this kind of tool to study that and, you know, find out in a particular setting. Now, as to how you would do it using this tool, we thought a lot about this as well. And for multiple attackers that are colluding together, and if you will, interacting through state and so forth, and have some common view. You model that, even though I kept using the word attacker in the singular, you can model that kind of attacker as, or that kind of set of attackers as a single attacker using this approach. And I just didn't talk about it in what we're doing to keep it simple, but we've done those kind of things. If you imagine a system in which there are lots of attackers that are completely independent from one another, that are acting on the system at the same time, and just, if you will, by luck or because of some sort of independent similar goals, they are changing system state in a way that helps each other or hurts each other. Our current implementation doesn't support those multiple attackers, but it's just an implementation detail. I say just an implementation detail, but I want to work on. With 3 months of or 4 months of programmer time, I can implement that. There's nothing difficult about that in all the theory that we're doing. We just didn't choose to implement it first, but we are going into a next phase that's going to be a major new development in the tool we are able to release to people with some funding we just got. So we probably will implement that. But that's a great question, and understanding. Again, it's about insights, but understanding those kind of choices you said, I don't think we as a community know now yet. So, and it's going to be system dependent. Well, I guess I'm out of time, according to the Keith rule. But thank you all. I had a lot of fun.
Thank you.